sofa away from the wall a little bit, crawled behind it, and lay down on his back with the shotgun by his left hand. His right hand, still curled around the handle of the steak knife, lay on his chest. There. Much better. George T. Nelson's deep pile carpeting was actually quite comfortable.
"You better be good, for goodness sake," Frank sang under his breath.
He was still singing in a low, snory voice 10 minutes later, when he finally dozed off.
"Unit 1!" Sheila screamed from the radio slung under the dash as Alan crossed the tin bridge on his way back into town. "Come in, Unit 1! Come in right now!" Alan felt a sickening lift drop in his stomach. Clut had run into a hornet's nest up at Hugh Priest's house on Castle Hill Road. He was sure of it. Why in Christ's name hadn't he told Clut to rendezvous with John before bracing Hugh? You know why. Because not all your attention was on your job when you were giving orders. If something's happened to Clut because of that, you'll have to face it and own the part of it that's yours. But that comes later. Your job right now is to do your job. So do it, Alan. Forget about Polly and do your damn job. He snatched the microphone off its prongs. Unit 1, come back. "Someone's beating John up," she screamed. "Come quick, Alan. He's hurting him bad." This information was so completely at odds with what Alan had expected that he was utterly flummoxed for a moment. "What? Who? There? Hurry up! He's killing him!" All at once it clicked home. It was Hugh Priest, of course. For some reason, Hugh had come to the sheriff's office, had arrived before John could get rolling for Castle Hill, and had started swinging. It was John LaPointe, not Andy Clutterbuck, who was in danger. Alan grabbed the dash flash, turned it on, and stuck it to the roof. When he reached the town side of the bridge, he offered the old station wagon a silent apology and floored the accelerator. Clut began to suspect Hugh wasn't home when he saw that all the tires on the man's car were not just flat, but cut to pieces. He was about to approach the house anyway when he finally heard thin cries for help. He stood where he was for a moment, undecided, then hurried back down the driveway. This time he saw Lenny lying on the side of the road and ran, holster flapping, to where the old man lay.
"Help me!" Lenny wheezed as Clut knelt by him. "Hugh Priest's gone crazy! Tunnel fools busted me right to Christ up!"
"Where you hurt, Lenny?" Clut asked. He touched the old man's shoulder. Lenny let out a shriek. It was as good an answer as any. Clut stood up, unsure of exactly what to do next. Too many things had gotten crammed up in his mind. All he knew for sure was that he desperately did not want to fuck this up. "Don't move," he said at last. "I'm going to call medical assistance."
"I ain't got no plans to get up and do the tango, you goddamn fool," Lenny said.
He was crying and snarling with pain. He looked like an old bloodhound with a broken leg. "Right," Clut said. He started to run back to his cruiser, then returned to Lenny again. "He took your car, right?"
"No," Lenny gasped, holding his hands against his broken ribs. "He busted me up, then flew off on a magic fucking carpet. Sure he took my car. Why do you think I'm laying here? Get a fucking tan?"
"Right," Clut repeated, and sprinted back down the road. Dimes and quarters bounced out of his pockets and spun across the macadam in bright little arcs. He leaned in the window of his car so fast he almost knocked himself out on the door ledge. He snagged the mic. He had to get Sheila to send help for the old man, but that wasn't the most important thing. Both Alan and the state police had to know that Hugh Priest was now driving Lenny Partridge's old Chevrolet Bel Air. Clut wasn't sure what year it was, but nobody could miss that dust-colored oil burner. But he could not raise Sheila in dispatch. He tried 3 times, and there was no answer. No answer at all. Now he could hear Lenny starting to scream again, and Clut went into Hugh's house to call rescue services in Norway on the telephone. One hell of a fine time for Sheila to have to use the John, he thought. Henry Beaufort was also trying to reach the sheriff's office. He stood against the bar with the telephone pressed against his ear. It rang again and again and again.
"Come on," he said. "Answer the fucking phone. What are you guys doing over there, playing gin rummy?"
Billy Tupper had gone outside. Henry heard him yell something and looked up impatiently. The yell was followed by a sudden loud bang. Henry's first thought was that one of Lenny's old tires had blown, and then there were 2 more bangs.
Billy walked back into the Tiger. He was walking very slowly. He was holding one hand against his throat, and blood was pouring through his fingers.
Henry!
Billy cried in a weird, strangled, cockney voice.
Henry! And...
He reached the rockola, stood there swaying for a moment, and then everything in his body seemed to let go at once, and he collapsed in a loose tumble. A shadow fell over his feet, which were almost out the door, and then the shadow's owner appeared. He was wearing a foxtail around his neck and holding a pistol in one hand. Smoke drifted from its barrel. Tiny jewels of perspiration nestled in the sparse mat of hair between his nipples. The skin under his eyes was puffy and brown. He stepped over Billy Tupper and into the dimness of the Mellow Tiger. "Hello, Henry," said Hugh Priest. John LaPointe didn't know why this was happening, but he knew that Lester was going to kill him if he kept it up, and Lester showed no sign of even slowing down, let alone stopping. He tried to slide down the wall and out of Lester's reach, but Lester grabbed his shirt and yanked him back up. Lester was still breathing easily. His own shirt had not even come untucked from the elastic waistband of his sweatpants. "Here you go, Johnny boy," Lester said, and smashed another fist into John's upper lip. John felt it split apart on his teeth. "Grow your goddamn pussy tickler over that." Blindly, John stuck out one leg behind Lester and pushed as hard as he could. Lester uttered a surprised yell and went over, but he shot both hands out as he toppled, snagged them in John's blood-spattered shirt, and pulled the deputy over on top of him. They began to roll across the floor, butting and punching. Both were far too busy to see Sheila Brigham dart out of the dispatcher's cubicle and into Allen's office. She snatched the shotgun off the wall, cocked it, and ran back into the bullpen area, which was now a shambles. Lester was sitting on top of John, industriously banging his head against the floor. Sheila knew how to use the gun she held. She had been target shooting since she was 8 years old. Now she socked the butt plate against her shoulder and screamed, "Get away from him, John! Give me a clear field!" Lester turned at the sound of her voice, his eyes glaring. He bared his teeth at Sheila like an angry bull gorilla, then went back to banging John's head on the floor. As Allen approached the municipal building, he saw the first unqualifiedly good thing of the day, Norris Ridgwick's VW approaching from the other direction. Norris was in plain clothes, but Allen cared not at all about that. He could use him this afternoon. Oh boy, how he could use him. Then that went to hell, too. A large red car, a Cadillac, license plate Keaton 1, suddenly shot out of the narrow alley which gave access to the municipal building's parking lot. Allen watched, gape-mouthed, as Buster drove his Cadillac into the side of Norris's Beetle. The caddy wasn't going fast, but it was roughly four times the size of Norris's car. There was a crunch of crimping metal, and the VW toppled over onto the passenger side with a hollow bang and a brisk tinkle of glass. Allen slammed on the brakes and got out of his station wagon. Buster was getting out of his Cadillac. Norris was struggling out through the window of his Volkswagen with a dazed expression on his face. Buster began to stalk toward Norris, his hands closing into fists. A frozen grin was rising on his fat, round face. Allen took one look at that grin and began to run. The first shot Hugh fired shattered a bottle of Wild Turkey on the back bar. The second shattered the glass over a framed document which hung on the wall just above Henry's head and left a round black hole in the liquor license beneath. The third tore off Henry Beaufort's right cheek in a pink cloud of blood and vaporized flesh. Henry shrieked, grabbed the box with the sawed-off shotgun inside, and dropped behind the bar. He knew Hugh had shot him, but he didn't know if it was bad or not. He was only aware that the right side of his face was suddenly as hot as a furnace, and that blood, warm, wet, and sticky, was pouring down the side of his neck. "Let's talk about cars, Henry," Hugh was saying as he approached the bar. "Even better than that, let's talk about my foxtail. What do you say?" Henry opened the box. It was lined with red velvet. He stuck his jittery, unstable hands in and pulled out the sawed-off Winchester. He started to break it, then realized there was no time. He would just have to hope it was loaded. He gathered his legs under him, getting ready to spring up and give Hugh what he sincerely hoped would be a big surprise.
Sheila realized John wasn't going to get out from under the crazy man, who she now believed was Lester Platt, or Pratt, the gym teacher at the high school anyway. She didn't think John could get out from under. Lester had stopped banging John's head against the floor and had closed his big hands around John's throat instead. Sheila reversed the gun, locked her hands on the barrel, and cocked it back over her shoulder like Ted Williams. Then she brought it around in a hard, smooth swing. Lester turned his head at the last moment, just in time to catch the gun's steel-edged walnut stock between his eyes. There was a nasty crunch as the gun stock smashed a hole into Lester's skull and turned his forebrain to jelly. It sounded as if someone had stepped very hard on a full box of popcorn. Lester Pratt was dead before he hit the floor. Sheila Brigham looked at him and began to scream.
"Did you think I wouldn't know who it was?"
Buster Keaton was grunting as he dragged Norris, who was dazed but unhurt, the rest of the way out of the VW's driver's side window.
"Did you think I wouldn't know with your name right at the bottom of every goddamn sheet of paper you taped up? Did you? Did you?"
He cocked one fist back to strike Norris, and Alan Pangborn slipped a handcuff around it as neatly as you please.
"Huh!"
Buster exclaimed, and wheeled ponderously around. Inside the municipal building, someone started to scream. Alan glanced in that direction, then used the cuff on the other end of the chain to pull Buster over to the open door of his own Cadillac. Buster flailed at him as he did so. Alan took several punches harmlessly on his shoulder and snapped the free cuff around the door handle of the car. He turned around and Norris was there. He had time to register the fact that Norris looked terrible, just terrible, and to dismiss it as a consequence of being rammed amidships by the head selectman. "Come on," he said to Norris. "We've got trouble." But Norris ignored him, at least for the moment. He brushed past Alan and punched Buster Keaton squarely in the eye. Buster let out a startled squawk and fell back against the door of his car. It was still open, and his weight drove it shut, catching the tail of his sweat-soaked white shirt in the latch.
"That's for the rat trap, you fat shit," Norris cried. "I'll get you," Buster screamed back. "Don't think I won't. I'll get all of you people." "Get this," Norris growled.
He was moving in again with his fists cocked at the sides of his puffed-up pigeon chest when Alan grabbed him and hauled him back.
"Quit it," he shouted into Norris's face. "We've got trouble inside. Bad trouble."
The scream lifted in the air again. People were gathering on the sidewalks of Lower Main Street now. Norris looked toward them, then back at Alan. His eyes had cleared, Alan saw with relief, and he looked like himself again, more or less. "What is it, Alan? Something to do with him?" He jerked his chin toward the Cadillac. Buster was standing there, looking sullenly at them and plucking at the handcuff on his wrist with his free hand. He seemed not to have heard the screams at all. "No," Alan said, "not a thing. Have you got your gun?" Norris shook his head. Alan unsnapped the safety strap on his holster, drew his Service 38, and handed it to Norris. "What about you, Alan?" Norris asked. "I want my hands free. Come on, let's go. Hugh Priest is in the office, and he's gone crazy." Hugh Priest had gone crazy, all right. Not much doubt about that, but he was a good 3 miles from the Castle Rock Municipal Building. "Let's talk about..." he began, and that was when Henry Beaufort leaped up from behind the bar like a jack-in-the-box, blood soaking the right side of his shirt, the shotgun leveled. Henry and Hugh fired at the same time. The crack of the automatic pistol was lost in the shotgun's blurred primal roar. Smoke and fire leaped from the truncated barrel. Hugh was lifted off his feet and driven across the room, bare heels dragging, his chest a disintegrating swamp of red muck. The gun flew out of his hand. The ends of the foxtail were burning. Henry was thrown against the back bar as Hugh's bullet punctured his right lung. Bottles tumbled and crashed all around him. A large numbness swarmed through his chest. He dropped the shotgun and staggered toward the telephone. The air was full of crazy perfume, spilled booze and burning fox hair. Henry tried to draw in breath, and although his chest heaved, he seemed to get no air. There was a thin, shrill sound as the hole in his chest sucked wind. The telephone seemed to weigh 1,000 pounds, but he finally got it to his ear and pressed the button which automatically dialed the sheriff's office. Ring, ring, ring.
"What the fuck's the matter with you people?"
Henry gasped raggedly. I'm dying up here. Answer the goddamn telephone.
But the telephone just went on ringing. Norris caught up with Alan halfway down the alley, and they walked side by side into the municipal building's small parking lot. Norris was holding Alan's service revolver with his finger curled around the trigger guard and the stubby barrel pointed up into the hot October sky. Sheila Brigham Saab was in the lot alongside Unit 4, John LaPointe's cruiser, but that was all. Alan wondered briefly where Hugh's car was, and then the side door to the sheriff's office burst open. Someone carrying the shotgun from Alan's office in a pair of bloody hands bolted out. Norris leveled the short barrel .38 and slid his finger inside the trigger guard. Alan registered two things at once. The first was that Norris was going to shoot. The second was that the screaming person with the gun was not Hugh Priest, but Sheila Brigham. Alan Pangborn's almost heavenly reflexes saved Sheila's life that afternoon, but it was a very close thing. He didn't bother trying to shout or even using his hand to deflect the pistol's barrel. Neither would have stood much chance of success. He stuck out his elbow instead, then jerked it up like a man doing an enthusiastic buck and wing at a country dance. It struck Norris's gun hand an instant before Norris fired, driving the barrel upward. The pistol shot was an amplified whip crack in the enclosed courtyard. A window in the town services office on the second floor shattered. Then Sheila dropped the shotgun she had used to brain Lester Pratt and was running toward them, screaming and weeping.
Jesus,
Norris said in a small, shocked voice. His face was as pale as paper as he thrust the pistol butt first toward Alan.
I almost shot Sheila. Oh, dear Jesus Christ. Alan! Sheila was crying. Thank God!
She ran into him without slowing, almost knocking him over. He holstered his revolver and then put his arms around her. She was trembling like an electric wire with too much current running through it. Alan suspected he was trembling pretty badly himself, and he had come close to wetting his pants. She was hysterical, blind with panic, and that was probably a blessing. He didn't think she had the slightest idea how close she had come to taking a round. What's going on in there, Sheila? He asked. Tell me quick. His ears were ringing so badly from the gunshot and the succeeding echo that he could almost swear he heard a telephone somewhere. Henry Beaufort felt like a snowman melting in the sun. His legs were giving way beneath him. He crumpled slowly into a kneeling position with the ringing, unanswered phone still tolling in his ear. His head swam with the mingled stench of booze and burning fur. Another hot smell was mingling with these now. He suspected it was Hugh Priest. He was vaguely aware that this wasn't working, and he ought to dial another number for help, but he didn't think he could do it. He was beyond ringing another number out of the telephone. This was it. So he knelt behind the bar, in a growing pool of his own blood, listening to the chimney hoot of air from the hole in his chest, clinging desperately to consciousness. The Tiger didn't open for an hour yet. Billy was dead, and if no one answered this telephone soon, he would also be dead when the first customers came trickling in for their various happy hour potations.
Please,
Henry whispered in a screamy, breathless voice.
Please, answer the phone. Someone please answer this fucking phone.
Sheila Brigham began to regain some control, and Alan got the most important thing out of her right away. She had decommissioned Hugh with the butt of the shotgun. No one was going to try to shoot them when they went through the door. He hoped. Come on, he said to Norris. Let's go.
Alan, when she came out, I thought...
I know what you thought, but no harm was done. Forget it, Norris. John's inside. Come on. They went to the door and stood on either side of it. Alan looked at Norris. Go in low, he said. Norris nodded his head. Alan grabbed the doorknob, jerked the door open, and lunged inside. Norris went in under him in a crouch. John had managed to find his feet and stagger most of the way to the door. Alan and Norris hit him like the front line of the old Pittsburgh Steelers, and John suffered a final, painful indignity. He was knocked flat by his colleagues and sent skidding across the tiled floor like one of the weights in a barroom bowling game. He struck the far wall with a thud and let out a scream of pain which was both surprised and somehow weary.
Jesus, that's John, Norris cried. What a French fire drill.
Help me with him, Alan said. They hurried across the room to John, who was slowly sitting up on his own. His face was a mask of blood. His nose was canted severely to the left. His upper lip was swelling like an overinflated inner tube. As Alan and Norris reached him, he cupped one hand under his mouth and spat a tooth into it.
He's crazy, John said in a mushy, dazed voice. Thela hit him with the thought gun. I think she killed him. John, are you all right? Norris asked.
I'm a fucking myth, John said.
He leaned forward and vomited extravagantly between his own spread legs to prove it. Alan looked around. He was vaguely aware that it wasn't just his ears. A telephone really was ringing. But the phone wasn't the important thing now. He saw Hugh lying face down by the rear wall and went over. He dropped his ear against the back of Hugh's shirt, listening for a heartbeat. All he could hear at first was the ringing in his ears. The goddamn telephones were ringing on every desk, it sounded like. Answer that fucking thing or take it off the hook, Alan snapped at Norris. Norris went to the closest phone. It happened to be on his own desk, punched the button that was flashing and picked it up. Don't bother us now, he said. We have an emergency situation here. You'll have to call back later. He dropped it back into its cradle without waiting for a response. Henry Beaufort took the telephone, the heavy, heavy telephone, away from his ear and looked at it with dimming, unbelieving eyes.
What did you say?
He whispered. Suddenly, he could no longer hold the telephone receiver. It was just too damned heavy. He dropped it on the floor, slowly collapsed onto his side, and lay there panting. As far as Alan could tell, Hugh was all finished. He grabbed him by the shoulders, rolled him over, and it wasn't Hugh at all. The face was too completely covered with blood, brains, and bits of bone for him to be able to tell who it was, but it surely wasn't Hugh Priest. What in the fuck is going on here? He said in a low, amazed voice. Danforth, Buster Keaton, stood in the middle of the street, handcuffed to his own Cadillac, and watched them watching him. Now that the chief persecutor and his deputy persecutor were gone, they had nothing else to watch. He looked at them and knew them for what they were, each and every one of them. Bill Fullerton and Henry Gendron were standing in front of the barber shop. Bobby Dugas was standing between them with a barber's apron still snapped around his neck and hanging down in front of him like an oversized dinner napkin. Charlie Fortin was standing in front of the Western Auto. Scott Garson and his puke lawyer friends, Albert Martin and Howard Potter, were standing in front of the bank, where they had probably been talking about him when the ruckus broke out. Eyes. Fucking eyes. There were eyes everywhere, all looking at him.
I see you, Buster cried suddenly. I see you all you people, and I know what to do. Yes, you bet.
He opened the door of his Cadillac and tried to get in. He couldn't do it. He was cuffed to the outside door handle. The chain between the cuffs was long, but not that long. Someone laughed. Buster heard that laugh quite clearly. He looked around. Many residents of Castle Rock stood in front of the businesses along Main Street, looking back at him with the black buckshot eyes of intelligent rats. Everyone was there but Mr. Gaunt. Yet Mr. Gaunt was there. Mr. Gaunt was inside Buster's head, telling him exactly what to do. Buster listened and began to smile. The Budweiser truck Hugh had almost sideswiped in town stopped at a couple of the little mom-and-pop stores on the other side of the bridge and finally pulled into the parking lot of the Mellow Tiger at 4:01 p.m. The driver got out, grabbed his clipboard, hitched up his green khaki pants, and marched toward the building. He stopped 5 feet away from the door, eyes widening. He could see a pair of feet in the bar's doorway.
Holy Joe! The driver exclaimed. You okay, buddy?
A faint, wheezing cry drifted to his ears.
Help! Help!
The driver ran inside and discovered Henry Beaufort, barely alive, crumpled behind the bar. If Lether Pratt, John LaPointe croaked. Supported by Norris on one side and Sheila on the other, he had hobbled over to where Alan knelt by the body. Who? Alan asked. He felt as if he had accidentally stumbled into some mad comedy. Ricky and Lucy go to hell. Hey, Lester, you got some splainin' to do. Lether Pratt, John said again, with painful patience. He's the physical education teacher at the high school. What's he doing here? Alan asked. John LaPointe shook his head wearily. Dunno, Alan. He just came in and went crazy. Somebody give me a break, Alan said. Where's Hugh Priest? Where's Clot? What in God's name is going on here? George T. Nelson stood in the doorway of his bedroom, looking around unbelievingly. The place looked as if some punk band, the Sex Pistols, maybe the Cramps, had had a party in it, along with all their fans. What? He began, and could say no more. Nor did he need to. He knew what. It was the coke. Had to be. He had been dealing among the faculty at Castle Rock High for the last 6 years. Not all the teachers were appreciators of what Ace sometimes called Bolivian bingo dust, but the ones who were qualified as big appreciators. And he'd left half an ounce of almost pure coke under the mattress. It was the blow, sure it was. Someone had talked, and someone else had gotten greedy. George supposed he'd known that as soon as he pulled into the driveway and saw the broken kitchen window. He crossed the room and yanked up the mattress with hands that felt dead and numb. Nothing underneath. The coke was gone. Nearly $2,000 worth of almost pure coke. Gone. He sleepwalked toward the bathroom to see if his own small stash was still in the Anison bottle on the top shelf of the medicine cabinet. He'd never needed a hit as badly as he did just now. He reached the doorway and stopped, eyes wide. It wasn't the mess that riveted his attention, although this room had also been turned upside down with great zeal. It was the toilet. The ring was down, and it was thinly dusted with white stuff. George had an idea that white stuff was not Johnson's baby powder. He walked across to the toilet, wetted his finger, and touched it to the dust. He put his finger in his mouth. The tip of his tongue went numb almost at once. Lying on the floor between the John and the tub was an empty plastic baggie. The picture was clear, crazy, but clear. Someone had come in, found the coke, and then flushed it down the crapper. Why? Why? He didn't know, but he decided when he found the person who had done this, he would ask, just before he tore his head right off his shoulders. It couldn't hurt. His own 3-gram stash was intact. He carried it out of the bathroom and then stopped again as a fresh shock struck his eyes. He hadn't seen this particular abomination as he crossed the bedroom from the hall, but from this angle, it was impossible to miss. He stood where he was for a long moment, eyes wide with amazed horror, his throat working convulsively. The nests of veins at his temples beat rapidly, like the wings of small birds. He finally managed to produce one small, strangled word.
Mom!
Downstairs, behind George T. Nelson's oatmeal-colored sofa, Frank Jewett slept on. The bystanders on Lower Main, who had been called out to the sidewalk by the yelling and the gunshot, were now being entertained by a new novelty, the slow-motion escape of their head selectman. Buster leaned as far into his Cadillac as he could and turned the ignition switch to the on position. He then pushed the button that lowered the power window on the driver's side. He closed the door again and carefully began to wriggle in through the window. He was still sticking out from the knees down, his left arm pulled back behind him at a severe angle by the handcuff around the door handle, the chain lying across his large left thigh, when Scott Garson came up. Danforth, the banker said hesitantly, I don't think you're supposed to do that. I believe you're arrested. Buster looked under his right armpit, smelling his own aroma, quite spicy by now, quite spicy indeed, and saw Garson upside down. He was standing directly behind Buster. He looked as if he might be planning to try to haul Buster back out of his own car. Buster pulled his legs up as much as he could and then shot them out hard, like a pony kicking up Dickens in the pasture. The heels of his shoes struck Garson's face with a smack which Buster found entirely satisfying. Garson's gold-rimmed spectacles shattered. He howled, reeled backward with his bleeding face in his hands, and fell on his back in Main Street.
Ha! Buster grunted. Didn't expect that, did you? Didn't expect that at all, you persecuting son of a bitch, did you?
He wriggled the rest of the way into his car. There was just enough chain. His shoulder joint creaked alarmingly and then rotated enough in its socket to allow him to wriggle under his own arm and scoot his ass back along the seat. Now he was sitting behind the wheel with his cuffed arm out the window. He started the car. Scott Garson sat up in time to see the Cadillac bearing down on him. Its grill seemed to leer at him, a vast chrome mountain which was going to crush him. He rolled frantically to the left, avoiding death by less than a second. One of the Cadillac's large front tires rolled over his right hand, squashing it pretty efficiently. Then the rear tire rolled over it, finishing the job. Garson lay on his back, looking at his grotesquely mashed fingers, which were now roughly the size of putty knives, and began to scream up into the hot blue sky.
Tammy Faye!
This shriek hauled Frank Jewett out of his deepening doze. He had absolutely no idea where he was in those first confused seconds, only that it was in some tight, close place, an unpleasant place. There was something in his hand, too. What was it? He raised his right hand and almost poked out his own eye with the steak knife.
Oh, no! Tammy Faye!
It came back to him all at once. He was behind the couch of his good old friend, George T. Nelson, and that was George T. Nelson himself, in the flesh, noisily mourning his dead parakeet. Along with this realization, everything else returned to Frank. The magazines scattered all over the office, the blackmail note, the possible, no, probable, the more he thought about it, the more probable it seemed, ruin of his career and his life. Now, incredibly, he could hear George T. Nelson sobbing, sobbing over a goddamn flying shithouse. Well, Frank thought, I'm going to put you out of your misery, George. Who knows, maybe you'll even wind up in bird heaven. The sobs were approaching the sofa, better and better. He would jump up, surprise, George, and the bastard would be dead before he had any idea what was up. Frank was on the verge of making his spring when George T. Nelson, still sobbing as if his heart would break, dropped onto his sofa. He was a heavy man, and his weight drove the sofa back smartly toward the wall. He did not hear the surprised, breathless oof from behind him. His own sobs covered it. He fumbled for the telephone, dialed through a shimmer of tears, and got, almost miraculously, Fred Rubin on the first ring.
Fred! He cried. Fred! Something terrible has happened. Maybe it's still happening. Oh, Jesus, Fred! Oh, Jesus!
Below and behind him, Frank Jewett was struggling for breath. Edgar Allan Poe stories he'd read as a kid, stories about being buried alive, raced through his head. His face was slowly turning the color of old brick. The heavy wooden leg, which had been forced against his chest when George T. Nelson collapsed onto the sofa, felt like a bar of lead. The back of the sofa lay against his shoulder and the side of his face. Above him, George T. Nelson was spilling a garbled description of what he'd found when he finally got home into Fred Rubin's ear. At last he paused for a moment and then cried out,
I don't care if I shouldn't be talking about it on the phone. How can I care when he killed Tammy Faye? The bastard killed Tammy Faye. Who could have done it, Fred? Who? You have to help me.
Another pause as George T. Nelson listened, and Frank realized with growing panic that he was soon going to pass out. He suddenly understood what he had to do, use the Llama automatic to shoot up through the sofa. He might not kill George T. Nelson, he might not even hit George T. Nelson, but he could sure as hell get George T. Nelson's attention, and once he did that, he thought the odds were good that George T. Nelson would get his fat ass off this sofa before Frank died down here, with his nose squashed against the baseboard heating unit. Frank opened the hand holding the steak knife and tried to reach for the pistol tucked into the waistband of his pants. Dreamlike horror washed through him as he realized he couldn't get it. His fingers were opening and closing, 2 full inches above the gun's ivory-inlaid handle. He tried with all his remaining strength to get the hand down lower, but his pinned shoulder would not move at all. The big sofa and George T. Nelson's considerable weight held it firmly against the wall. It might have been nailed there. Black roses, harbingers of approaching asphyxiation, began to bloom before Frank's bulging eyes. As from some impossible distance, he heard his old friend screaming at Fred Rubin, who undoubtedly had been George T. Nelson's partner in the cocaine deal.
What are you talking about? I called to tell you I've been violated, and you tell me to go see the new guy down street? I don't need knickknacks, Fred. I need...
He broke off, got up, and paced across the room. With what was literally the last of his strength, Frank managed to push the sofa a few inches away from the wall. It wasn't much, but he was able to take small sips of incredibly wonderful air.
He sells what? George T. Nelson shouted. Well, Jesus! Jesus H. Christ! Why didn't you say so in the first place?
Silence again. Frank lay behind the sofa like a beached whale, sipping air and hoping his monstrously pounding head would not explode. In a moment, he would arise and blow his old friend, George T. Nelson's faucets, off. In a moment, when he got his breath back, and when the big black flowers currently filling his sight shrank back into nothing. In a moment, 2 at the most.
Okay, George T. Nelson said, I'll go see him. I doubt if he's the miracle worker you think he is, but any goddamn port in a storm, right? I have to tell you something, though. I don't give much of a shit if he's dealing or not. I'm going to find the son of a bitch who did this. That's the first goddamn order of business, and I'm going to nail him to the nearest wall. Have you got that?
I got it, Frank thought, but just who nails who to that fabled wall still remains to be seen, my dear old party buddy.
Yes, I did get the name, George T. Nelson screamed into the phone. Gaunt, Gaunt, fucking Gaunt!
He slammed the phone down, then must have thrown it across the room. Frank heard the shatter of breaking glass. Seconds later, George T. Nelson uttered a final oath and stormed out of the house. The engine of his IROC Z raved to life. Frank heard him backing down the driveway as he himself slowly pushed the sofa away from the wall. Rubber screamed against pavement outside, and then Frank's old friend, George T. Nelson, was gone. 2 minutes later, a pair of hands rose into view and clutched the back of the oatmeal-colored sofa. A moment after that, the face of Frank M. Jewett, pale and crazed, the rimless Mr. Weatherby glasses sitting askew on his small pug nose and one lens cracked, appeared between the hands. The sofa back and left a red stippled pattern on his right cheek. A few dust bunnies danced in his thinning hair. Slowly, like a bloated corpse rising from the bed of a river until it floats just below the surface, the grin reappeared on Frank's face. He had missed his old friend, George T. Nelson, this time, but George T. Nelson had no plans to leave town. His phone conversation had made that quite clear. Frank would find him before the day was over. In a town the size of Castle Rock, how could he miss? Sean Rusk stood in the kitchen doorway of his house, looking anxiously out at the garage. 5 minutes before, his older brother had gone out there. Sean had been looking out of his bedroom window and had just happened to see him. Brian had been holding something in one hand. The distance had been too great for Sean to see what it was, but he didn't need to see. He knew. It was the new baseball card, the one Brian kept creeping upstairs to look at. Brian didn't know Sean knew about that card, but Sean did. He even knew who was on it, because he'd gotten home much earlier from school today than Brian, and he had sneaked into Brian's room to look at it. He didn't have the slightest idea why Brian cared about it so much. It was old, dirty, dog-eared, and faded. Also, the player was somebody Sean had never heard of, a pitcher for the Los Angeles Dodgers named Sammy Coburg. Lifetime record, 1 win, 3 losses. The guy had never even spent a whole year in the majors. Why would Brian care about a worthless card like that? Sean didn't know. He only knew 2 things for sure. Brian did care, and the way Brian had been acting for the last week or so was scary. It was like those TV ads you saw about kids on drugs. But Brian wouldn't use drugs, would he?
Something about Brian's face when he went out to the garage had scared Sean so badly he had gone to tell his mother. He wasn't sure exactly what to say, and it turned out not to matter because he didn't get a chance to say anything. She was mooning around in the bedroom, wearing her bathrobe and those stupid sunglasses from the new store downtown. "Mom, Brian's," he began, and that was as far as he got. "Go away, Sean. Mommy's busy right now." "But, Mom..." "Go away," I said. And before he had a chance to go on his own, he'd found himself hustled unceremoniously out of the bedroom. Her bathrobe fell open as she pushed him, and before he could look away, he saw that she was wearing nothing beneath it, not even a nightgown. She had slammed the door behind him and locked it. Now, he stood in the kitchen doorway, waiting anxiously for Brian to come back out of the garage, but Brian didn't. His unease had grown in some stealthy way until it was barely controlled terror. Sean went out the kitchen door, trotted through the breezeway, and entered the garage. It was dark and oily-smelling and explosively hot inside. For a moment he didn't see his brother in the shadows and thought he must have gone out through the back door into the yard. Then his eyes adjusted, and he uttered a small, whimpery gasp. Brian was sitting against the rear wall next to the lawn boy. He had gotten Daddy's rifle. The butt was propped on the floor. The muzzle was pointed at his own face. Brian was supporting the barrel with one hand, while the other clutched the dirty old baseball card which had somehow gained such a hold over his life this last week. "Brian," Sean cried, "what are you doing?" "Don't come any closer, Sean. You'll get the mess on you."
"Brian, don't!" Sean cried, beginning to weep. "Don't be such a wussy. You're scaring me."
"I want you to promise me something," Brian said. He had taken off his socks and sneakers, and now he wriggled one of his big toes into the Remington's trigger guard. Sean felt his crotch grow wet and warm. He had never been so scared in his life.
"Brian, please, please."
"I want you to promise me you'll never go to the new store," Brian said. "Do you hear me?" Sean took a step toward his brother. Brian's toe tightened on the trigger of the rifle.
"No!" Sean screamed, drawing back at once. "I mean, yes! Yes!"
Brian let the barrel drop a little when he saw his brother retreat. His toe relaxed a bit. "Promise me."
"Yes! Anything you want. Only, don't do that. Don't tease me anymore, Bri. Let's go in and watch the Transformers. No, you pick. Anything you want. Even Wapner. We can watch Wapner if you want to. All week. All month. I'll watch with you. Only stop scaring me, Brian. Please stop scaring me."
Brian Rusk might not have heard. His eyes seemed to float in his distant, serene face. "Never go there," he said. "Needful Things is a poisoned place, and Mr. Gaunt is a poison man. Only he's really not a man, Sean. He's not a man at all. Swear to me you'll never buy any of the poison things Mr. Gaunt sells."
"I swear, I swear," Sean babbled. "I swear on Mommy's name."
"No," Brian said. "You can't do that because he got her, too. Swear on your own name, Sean. Swear it on your very own name."
"I do,"
Sean cried out in the hot, dim garage. He held his hands out imploringly to his brother.
"I really do. I swear on my very own name. Now please put the gun down, Bri."
"I love you, baby brother," Brian said. He looked down at the baseball card for a moment. "Sandy Koufax sucks," Brian Rusk remarked, and pulled the trigger with his toe. Sean's drilling shriek of horror rose over the blast, which was flat and loud in the hot, dark garage. Leland Gaunt stood at his shop window, looking out on Main Street and smiling gently. The sound of the shot from up on Ford Street was faint, but his ears were sharp, and he heard it. His smile broadened a little. He took down the sign in the window, the one which said he was open by appointment only, and put up a new one. This one read, "Closed until further notice." "We're having fun now," Leland Gaunt said to no one at all. Yes, sirree. Polly Chalmers knew nothing of these things. While Castle Rock was bearing the first real fruits of Mr. Gaunt's labors, she was out at the end of Town Road Number 3 at the old Camber place. She had gone there as soon as she had finished her conversation with Alan. Finished it? She thought. Oh, my dear, that's much too civilized, after you hung up on him. Isn't that what you mean? All right, she agreed, after I hung up on him. But he went behind my back, and when I called him on it, he got all flustered and then lied about it. He lied about it. I happen to think that behavior like that deserves an uncivilized response. Something stirred uneasily in her at this, something which might have spoken if she had given it time and room, but she gave it neither. She wanted no dissenting voices, did not, in fact, want to think about her last conversation with Alan Pangborn at all. She just wanted to take care of her business out here at the end of Town Road Number 3 and then go home. Once she was there, she intended to take a cool bath and then go to bed for 12 or 16 hours. That deep voice managed just 5 words. But Polly, have you thought? No, she hadn't. She supposed she would have to think in time, but now was too soon. When the thinking began, the hurting would begin too. For now, she only wanted to take care of business and not think at all. The Camber place was spooky, reputed by some to be haunted. Not so many years ago, 2 people, a small boy and Sheriff George Bannerman, had died in the dooryard of this house. 2 others, Gary Pervier and Joe Camber himself, had died just down the hill. Polly parked her car over the place where a woman named Donna Trenton had once made the fatal mistake of parking her Ford Pinto and got out. The Ozka swung back and forth between her breasts as she did. She looked around uneasily for a moment at the sagging porch, the paintless walls overrun by climbing ivy, the windows which were mostly broken and stared blindly back at her. Crickets sang their stupid songs in the grass, and the hot sun beat down as it had on those terrible days when Donna Trenton had fought for her life here and for the life of her son. What am I doing here? Polly thought. What in God's name am I doing here? But she knew, and it had nothing to do with Alan Pangborn or Kelton or the San Francisco Department of Child Welfare. This little field trip had nothing to do with love. It had to do with pain. That was all. But that was enough. There was something inside the small silver charm, something that was alive. If she did not live up to her side of the bargain she had made with Leland Gaunt, it would die. She didn't know if she could stand to be tumbled back down into the horrible, grinding pain to which she had awakened on Sunday morning. If she had to face a lifetime of such pain, she thought she would kill herself. And it's not Alan, she whispered as she walked toward the barn with its gaping doorway and its ominous sway-backed roof. He said he wouldn't raise a hand against him. Why do you even care? That worrisome voice whispered. She cared because she didn't want to hurt Alan. She was angry at him, yes, furious, in fact. But that didn't mean she had to stoop to his level, that she had to treat him as shabbily as he had treated her. But Polly, have you thought? No. No. She was going to play a trick on Ace Merrill, and she didn't care about Ace at all, had never even met him, only knew him by reputation. The trick was on Ace, but Alan, who had sent Ace Merrill away to Shawshank, came into it someplace. Her heart told her so. And could she back out of this? Could she, even if she wanted to? Now it was Kelton as well. Mr. Gaunt hadn't exactly told her that the news of what had happened to her son would end up all over town unless she did what he told her to do. But he had hinted as much. She couldn't bear for that to happen. Is a woman not entitled to her pride? When everything else is gone, is she not at least entitled to this, the coin without which her purse is entirely empty? Yes, and yes, and yes. Mr. Gaunt had told her she'd find the only tools she would need in the barn. Now Polly began to walk slowly in that direction. "Go where ye list, but go there alive, Tricia," Aunt Evie had told her. "Don't be no ghost." But now, stepping into the Camber barn through doors which hung gaping and frozen on their rusty tracks, she felt like a ghost. She had never felt more like a ghost in her life. The Oscar moved between her breasts, on its own now. Something inside, something alive. She didn't like it, but she liked the idea of what would happen if that thing died even less. She would do what Mr. Gaunt had told her to do, at least this once, cut all her ties with Alan Pangborn. It had been a mistake to ever begin with him. She saw that now, saw it clearly. And keep her past her own. Why not? After all, it was such a little thing. The shovel was exactly where he had told her it would be, leaning against one wall in a dusty shaft of sunlight. She took hold of its smooth, worn handle. Suddenly she seemed to hear a low, purring growl from the deep shadows of the barn, as if the rabid St. Bernard, which had killed Big George Bannerman and caused the death of Tad Trenton, were still here, back from the dead and meaner than ever. Goose flesh danced up her arms, and Polly left the barn in a hurry. The dooryard was not exactly cheery, not with that empty house glaring sullenly at her, but it was better than the barn. "What am I doing here?" her mind asked again, woefully, and it was Aunt Evie's voice that came back. "Goin' ghost, that's what you're doing. You're goin' ghost." Polly squeezed her eyes shut. "Stop it," she whispered fiercely. "Just stop it." "That's right," Leland Gaunt said. "Besides, what's the big deal? It's only a harmless little joke. And if something serious were to come of it, it won't, of course, but just supposing, for the sake of argument, that it did, whose fault would that be?"
"Alan's,"
she whispered. Her eyes rolled nervously in their sockets, and her hands clenched and unclenched nervously between her breasts. "If he were here to talk to, if he hadn't cut himself off from me by snooping around in things that are none of his business..." The little voice tried to speak up again, but Leland Gaunt cut it off before it could say a word. "Right again," Gaunt said. "As to what you're doing here, Polly, the answer to that is simple enough. You're paying. That's what you're doing, and that's all you're doing. Ghosts have nothing to do with it. And remember this, because it is the simplest, most wonderful aspect of commerce. Once an item is paid for, it belongs to you. You didn't expect such a wonderful thing to come cheap, did you? But when you finish paying, it's yours. You have a clear title to the thing you have paid for. Now will you stand here listening to those old frightened voices all day, or will you do what you came to do?" Polly opened her eyes again. The Oscar hung movelessly at the end of its chain. If it had moved, and she was no longer sure it had stopped now. The house was just a house, empty too long and showing the inevitable signs of neglect. The windows were not eyes, but simply holes rendered glassless by adventuresome boys with rocks. If she had heard something in the barn, and she was no longer sure she had, it had only been the sound of a board expanding in the unseasonable October heat. Her parents were dead. Her sweet little boy was dead. And the dog which had ruled this dooryard so terribly and completely for 3 summer days and nights 11 years ago was dead. There were no ghosts.
"Not even me," she said, and began to walk around the barn.
"When you go around to the back of the barn," Mr. Gaunt had said, "you'll see the remains of an old trailer." She did. A silver-sided airflow, almost obscured by goldenrod and high tangles of late sunflowers. "You'll see a large flat rock at the left end of the trailer." She found it easily. It was as large as a garden paving stone. "Move the rock and dig. About 2 feet down, you'll find a Crisco can." She tossed the rock aside and dug. Less than 5 minutes after she started, the shovel's blade clunked on the can. She discarded the shovel and dug into the loose earth with her fingers, breaking the light webwork of roots with her fingers.
A minute later, she was holding the Crisco can. It was rusty but intact. The rotting label came loose, and she saw a recipe for pineapple surprise cake on the back. The list of ingredients was mostly obscured by a black blotch of mold, along with a biscuit coupon that had expired in 1969. She got her fingers under the lid of the can and pried it loose. The whiff of air that escaped made her wince and draw her head back for a moment. That voice tried one last time to ask what she was doing here, but Polly shut it out. She looked into the can and saw what Mr. Gaunt had told her she would see, a bundle of gold bond trading stamps and several fading photographs of a woman having sexual intercourse with a collie dog. She took these things out, stuffed them into her hip pocket, and then wiped her fingers briskly on the leg of her jeans. She would wash her hands as soon as she could, she promised herself. Touching these things, which had lain so long under the earth, made her feel unclean. From her other pocket, she took a sealed business envelope. Typed on the front in capital letters was this: A message for the intrepid treasure hunter. Polly put the envelope in the can, pressed the cover back down, and dropped it into the hole again. She used the shovel to fill in the hole, working quickly and carelessly. All she wanted right now was to get the hell out of here. When she was done, she walked away fast. The shovel she slung into the high weeds. She had no intention of taking it back to the barn, no matter how mundane the explanation of the sound she had heard might be. When she reached her car, she opened first the passenger door and then the glove compartment. She pawed through the litter of paper inside until she found an old book of matches. It took her 4 tries to produce 1 small flame. The pain had almost entirely left her hands, but they were shaking so badly that she struck the first 3 much too hard, bending the paper heads uselessly to the side. When the 4th flared alight, she held it between 2 fingers of her right hand, the flame almost invisible in the hot afternoon sunlight, and took the matted pile of trading stamps and dirty pictures from her jeans pocket. She touched the flame to the bundle and held it there until she was sure it had caught. Then she cast the match aside and dipped the papers down to produce maximum draft. The woman was malnourished and hollow-eyed. The dog looked mangy and just smart enough to be embarrassed. It was a relief to watch the surface of the 1 photograph she could see bubble and turn brown. When the pictures began to curl up, she dropped the flaming bundle into the dirt where a woman had once beaten another dog, this one a St. Bernard, to death with a baseball bat. The flames flared. The little pile of stamps and photos quickly crumpled to black ash. The flames guttered, went out, and at the moment they did, a sudden gust of wind blew through the stillness of the day, breaking the clot of ash up into flakes. They whirled upward in a funnel, which Polly followed with eyes that had suddenly gone wide and frightened. Where exactly had that freak gust of wind come from? Oh, please, can't you stop being so damp? At that moment, the growling sound, low, like an idling outboard motor, rose from the hot, dark maw of the barn again. It wasn't her imagination, and it wasn't a creaking board. It was a dog. Polly looked that way, frightened, and saw 2 sunken red circles of light peering out at her from the darkness. She ran around the car, bumping her hip painfully against the right side of the hood in her hurry, got in, rolled up the windows, and locked the doors. She turned the ignition key. The engine cranked over, but did not start. No one knows where I am, she realized. No one but Mr. Gaunt, and he wouldn't tell. For a moment, she imagined herself trapped out here, the way Donna Trenton and her son had been trapped. Then the engine burst into life, and she backed out of the driveway so fast she almost ran her car into the ditch on the far side of the road. She dropped the transmission into drive and headed back to town as fast as she dared to go. She had forgotten all about washing her hands. Ace Merrill rolled out of bed around the same time that Brian Rusk was blowing his head off 30 miles away. He went into the bathroom, shucking out of his dirty skivvies as he walked and urinated for an hour or two. He raised one arm and sniffed his pit. He looked at the shower and decided against it. He had a big day ahead of him. The shower could wait. He left the bathroom without bothering to flush. If it's yellow, let it mellow was an integral part of Ace's philosophy, and went directly to the bureau, where the last of Mr. Gaunt's blow was laid out on a shaving mirror. It was great stuff, easy on the nose, hot in the head. It was also almost gone. Ace had needed a lot of go power last night, just as Mr. Gaunt had said, but he had a pretty good idea there was more where this had come from. Ace used the edge of his driver's license to shape a couple of lines. He snorted them with a rolled-up $5 bill, and something that felt like a Shrike missile went off in his head. "Boom!" cried Ace Merrill in his best Warner Wolf voice. "Let's go to the videotape!" He pulled a pair of faded jeans up over his naked hips and then got into a Harley Davidson t-shirt. It's what all the well-dressed treasure hunters are wearing this year, he thought, and laughed wildly. My, that coke was fine. He was on his way out the door when his eye fell on last night's take, and he remembered that he had meant to call Nat Copeland in Portsmouth. He went back into the bedroom, dug through the clothes, which were balled helter-skelter in his top bureau drawer, and finally came up with a battered address book. He went back into the kitchen, sat down, and dialed the number he had. He doubted that he would actually catch Nat in, but it was worth a try. The coke buzzed and whipsawed in his head, but he could already feel the rush tapering off. A headshot of cocaine made a new man of you. The only trouble was, the first thing the new man wanted was another one, and Ace's supply was severely depleted. "Yeah?" a wary voice said in his ear, and Ace realized he had beaten the odds again. His luck was in. "Nat!" he cried. "Who the fuck says so?" "I do, old hoss, I do." "Ace? That you?" "None other. How you doing, old Natty?" "I've been better." Nat sounded less than overjoyed to hear from his old machine shop buddy at Shawshank. "What do you want, Ace?" "Now, is that any way to talk to a pal?" Ace asked reproachfully. He cocked the phone between his ear and shoulder and pulled a pair of rusty tin cans toward him. One of them had come out of the ground behind the old Treblehorn place, the other from the cellar hole of the old Masters farm, which had burned flat when Ace was only 10 years old. The first can had contained only 4 books of S&H green stamps and several banded packets of Raleigh cigarette coupons. The second had contained a few sheafs of mixed trading stamps and 6 rolls of pennies. Except they didn't look like regular pennies. They were white. "Maybe I just wanted to touch base," Ace teased. "You know, check on the state of your piles, see how your supply of KY's holding out, things like that." "What do you want, Ace?" Nat Copeland repeated wearily. Ace plucked one of the penny rolls out of the old Crisco can. The paper had faded from its original purple to a dull wash pink. He shook 2 of the pennies out into his hand and looked at them curiously. If anyone would know about these things, Nat Copeland was the guy. He had once owned a shop in Kittery called Copeland's Coins and Collectibles. He'd also had his own private coin collection, one of the 10 best in New England, at least according to Nat himself. Then he, too, had discovered the wonders of cocaine. In the 4 or 5 years following this discovery, he had dismantled his coin collection item by item and put it up his nose. In 1985, police responding to a silent alarm at the Long John Silver coin shop in Portland had found Nat Copeland in the back room stuffing Lady Liberty silver dollars into a chamois bag. Ace met him not long after. "Well, I did have a question, now that you mention it." "A question? That's all?" "That's absolutely all, good buddy." "All right." Nat's voice relaxed the smallest bit. "Ask, then. I don't have all day." "Right," Ace said. "Busy, busy, busy. Places to go and people to eat. Am I right, Natty?" He laughed crazily. It wasn't just the blow. It was the day. He hadn't gotten in until first light. The coke he had ingested had kept him awake until almost 10 this morning, in spite of the drawn shades and his physical exertions, and he still felt ready to eat steel bars and spit out 10-penny nails. And why not? Why the fuck not? He was standing on the rim of a fortune. He knew it. He felt it in every fiber. "Ace, is there really something on that thing you call your mind, or did you just phone to rag me?" "Nope, I didn't call to rag you. Give me the straight dope, Natty, and I might give you some straight dope. Very straight." "Really?" Nat Copeland's voice lost its edge at once. It became hushed, almost awed. "Are you shitting me, Ace?" "The best primoest shit I ever had, Natty Bumpo, my lad." "Can you cut me in?" "I wouldn't doubt it a bit," Ace said, meaning to do no such thing. He had pried 3 or 4 more of the strange pennies out of their old faded roll. Now he pushed them into a straight line with his finger. But you've got to do me a favor. Name it. What do you know about white pennies? There was a pause on the other end of the line. Then Nat said cautiously, White pennies? Do you mean steel pennies? I don't know what I mean. You're the coin collector, not me. Look at the dates. See if they're from the years 1941 to 1945. Ace turned over the pennies in front of him. One was a 1941, 4 were 1943s, the last was from 1944. Yeah, they are. What are they worth, Nat? He tried to disguise the eagerness in his voice and was not entirely successful. Not a lot, taken one by one, Nat said, but a hell of a lot more than ordinary pennies. Maybe $2 apiece, 3 if they're UC. What's that? Uncirculated, in mint condition. Have you got a lot, Ace? Quite a few, Ace said. Quite a few, Nanny, my man. But he was disappointed. He had 6 rolls, 300 pennies, and the ones he was looking at didn't look in particularly good shape to him. They weren't exactly beat to shit, but they were a long way from being shiny and new. $600, 800 tops. Not what you'd call a big strike. Well, bring them down and let me look, Nat said. I can get you top dollar. He hesitated, then added, and bring some of that marching powder with you. I'll think about it, Ace said. Hey, Ace, don't hang up. Fuck you very much, Natty, Ace replied, and did just that. He sat where he was for a moment, brooding over the pennies and the 2 rusty cans. There was something very weird about all of this. Useless trading stamps and $600 worth of steel pennies. What did that add up to? That's the bitch of it, Ace thought. It doesn't add up to anything. Where's the real stuff? Where's the goddamn loot? He pushed back from the table, went into the bedroom, and snorted the rest of the blow Mr. Gaunt had laid on him. When he came out again, he had the book with the map in it, and he was feeling considerably more cheerful. It did add up. It added up just fine. Now that he had helped his head a bit, he could see that. After all, there had been lots of crosses on that map. He had found 2 caches right where those crosses suggested they would be, each marked with a large flat stone. Crosses plus flat stones equal buried treasure. It did seem that Pop had been a little softer in his old age than people from town had believed, that he'd had a bit of a problem telling the difference between diamonds and dust there at the end. But the big stuff, gold, currency, maybe negotiable securities, had to be out there someplace under one or more of those flat rocks. He had proved that. His uncle had buried things of value, not just bunches of moldy old trading stamps. At the old master's farm, he had found 6 rolls of steel pennies worth at least $600. Not much, but an indication. It's out there, Ace said softly. His eyes sparkled madly. It's all out there, in one of those other 7 holes, or 2, or 3. He knew it. He took the brown paper map out of the book and let his finger wander from one cross to the next, wondering if some were more likely than others. Ace's finger stopped on the old Joe Camber place. It was the only location where there were 2 crosses close together. His finger began to move slowly back and forth between them. Joe Camber had died in a tragedy that had taken 3 other lives. His wife and boy had died.